Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Asian American Studies. I'm Ian Shin, one of the hosts of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Mark Padungpat about his new book, Flavors of Empire, Food and the Making of Thai America, published in 2017 by the University of California Press. Mark is an assistant professor of Asian and Asian American Studies and Interdisciplinary Studies at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and he recently added the title of Director of Asian American Studies at UNLV. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
It's great to have you and to talk to you today. Mark, I wonder if you could start the conversation today by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, definitely. I'm a second generation Thai American. I was born and raised in Los Angeles. Grew up in the East San Fernando Valley, and did my undergrad at the University of Oregon. Double majored in ethnic studies and history, and then earned my PhD in American Studies and Ethnicity at USC, the University of Southern California. Did you want me to talk a little bit about? Did you want me to talk a little bit about the book? How I came to the project?
No, let's. I'd love to hear a little. I'd love to hear a little bit more about your background. You actually outline it, I think, in a really beautifully personal way in the conclusion. Not to jump right to the end, but you talk about some of the ways in which your experiences growing up in Pacoima, right, which is a working class Latino suburb in the 1980s, how that actually fueled some of your interest in this topic. So. What was that experience like, and sort of how do you think about your growing up in that area, and how does that personal connection feed into your project?
Yeah, I mean, the project was, you know, I think in a number of different ways it was very personal for me. I mean, I think growing up in a working class suburb in Los Angeles around a largely Latino population, I think really shaped my identity. My racial and ethnic identity in a number of ways, both in terms of being second generation immigrant to the United States, and also just trying to learn and navigate American society in a multiracial, multiethnic setting. And I think it was interesting to grow up in a place where whites were the minority, and how that in some ways sort of blinded me. Right, you would think that my racial consciousness would have been sort of at a high level growing up in that environment, but I was really sort of colorblind growing up, thinking that there was no kind of racial ethnic discrimination. Systemic racism obviously wasn't a thing, even though we were living in the trenches of it and living living with its consequences in that neighborhood. And it wasn't until I got to the University of Oregon that all of that started making sense to me, why we were living in the same neighborhoods and why my parents moved to Pacoima and why we were living in that particular neighborhood. And so it really compelled me and pushed me to want to study my community and my population and, you know, Thai Americans in Los Angeles.
Yeah. So. In the conclusion, you write specifically about your connection to some of these institutions in the community, in the Thai community in LA, right? That you remember spending days at the weekend food festival at Wat Thai, the Buddhist temple in Los Angeles. So did those connections end up helping you to write the book later on when you started doing research? Were you able to use some of the relationships that you'd developed growing up in the area? Or how did you decide in some ways on what aspects of the community to focus on, given your own personal connections to it?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is really the heart of how I came to the book, right? I mean, I think the funny thing is, like, I didn't want to write a book about Thai food. That was something that was a conscious decision of mine, not to focus on Thai food. I think when I started, you know, thinking of writing a history of Thai Americans while I was at Oregon, it really started when I was an undergrad under my mentor, Peggy Pasco, Matt Garcia, Martin Summers, Fiona Ngo. When I started really thinking about the project, I knew I wanted to write a history of my community, and I knew I wanted to focus on Wat Thai because of the connections I had there, and because I knew the kind of political work that was being done at Wat Thai, and so I wanted to write that history, to document that history, because it didn't exist, and I knew that you know, wanted to kind of focus on immigration, these formal, informal cultural practices that were taking place at the Thai temple, all of the stuff I kind of grew up with, right? But I knew that I didn't want to focus on food because I felt like even at the time, everything, I felt like every person, the only way that they knew about Thai people was through food. And that this kind of hyper invisibility of Thai food and the invisibility of Thai people was really something that I didn't want to perpetuate, even as, you know, especially when I started getting, when I got into grad school and started researching and writing their dissertation. And it just, I just felt like food had become a stand-in for Thai people. And, you know, when I would meet people, right, like the first thing they would say when they hear that I'm Thai is, yeah, I love Thai food, as if they kind of had me figured out right away because of, because they had some pot Thai last week, right? Like, I think that it was a big reason why I wanted to avoid it. I didn't want to be, I didn't want to perpetuate that. And also I felt like Thai food was in some ways a distraction from real issues, right? There were Thai immigrants, a lot of whom were undocumented, who were struggling with housing, labor exploitation, access to healthcare. And so part of me was just like, why, you know, why do I want to focus on food when there are so many other issues outside of food that need to be addressed, and that there's a story outside of Thai food about Thai immigrants that people need to know? And so that's when, you know, I started focusing really on telling the story of Thai Americans in Los Angeles outside of food. But then I struggled. And, you know, part of that was because, you know, to tell the other side of the community outside of food, there weren't enough sources to do it. Frankly, people kind of didn't really care about Thais. To the outside world, it's such a small, insignificant population in terms of numbers. But then, you know, I sort of had a breakthrough moment in grad school. A number of things started happening. The Thai Community Development Center, which I volunteered at in East Hollywood, they were using Thai food and culinary tourism to spur the revitalization of Thai Town. There were a number of food festivals at Thai Buddhist temples. The one I grew up with in North Hollywood, the one that's, you know, close to me, the city of Los Angeles placed a moratorium on food festivals in 2007 at the Wat Thai of Los Angeles, because the neighbors were complaining that the festivals were bringing parking and noise and trash and weird smells into the neighborhood. And, you know, the Thai government in the early 2000s began training and exporting Thai chefs to different parts of the world under an economic development program called Thai Kitchen to the World. So just a lot of different things were happening around Thai food. And then I revisited my own experiences with food and growing up with food and what it meant for me in terms of offering a tangible ethnic identity, especially at the Thai temple, growing up in Pacoima. And so I just started thinking about food as an entry point into all the issues that I originally wanted to talk about: identity formation, community, immigration, labor, you know, race, gender, and class. And so I just decided, you know what, I'm just going to flip this on its head. And I'm going to take America's fascination with Thai cuisine and address it head on. And if it's, for me, the question was, you know, if it's true that Thai food has become hyper visible and Thai people are relatively invisible, how did that come to be? And how did, you know, these are the questions that I started asking. So, you know, why? How did this happen? How did Thai food become essentially a stand-in for Thai people in the United States? And what were the factors that made food important to Thai Americans in Los Angeles? And what could that tell us about U.S. society more broadly? So that's, you know, the book stemmed from that personal connection I had with food, but it's a very kind of ambivalent relationship that I had with Thai food.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I have to say, you know, it as we'll talk about in a little bit, the structure of the book, you know, sort of maps really well to you're unraveling these connections to different parts of the community. I wondered before we get into even the first chapter, though, I'm curious because you said when you were at the University of Oregon that you, I believe, had double majored in American studies or ethnic studies and history, but you know clearly ended up doing your PhD in American studies and ethnicity at USC, and have written, I think, what most historians would agree is a pretty conventionally historical book. So how have you thought about your methodology and your training in terms of what from American studies or ethnic studies you found helpful to a historical project that's focused on the second half of the 20th century about the Thai community in the United States, but also, you know, as we'll talk about in a bit, U.S. empire in Thailand?
Yeah, I mean, I think the main thing for me was that I felt like, you know, I had a love for history. And again, I wanted to tell the story the best way that I could, to tell the story of Thai Americans in Los Angeles. But I also felt like a lot of the stuff I was reading at the time, a lot of history books that I was reading on Asian Americans sort of treated race as a kind of fixed thing, right? That race had already kind of existed. And then, of course, you know, a number of works started coming out that you can clearly see, you know, scholars like Nyan Shaw. You can clearly see that ethnic studies was the lens in which they were trying to understand not just the history of Chinese immigrants or Asian Americans, but also how that category came to be. And so for me, it just made sense to kind of tell the history, but to really come at it from an ethnic studies perspective, to think about intersectionality, to think about kind of the transnational processes of racial formation that, at least to me, I saw a lot of kind of historians starting to make that turn, but it was still very much, you know, the identities had already been for these groups were already established, and that their experiences were based on that kind of fixed identity, as opposed to, you know, there are processes that construct these identities in these communities.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's hopefully something that historians, you know, and as somebody who's trained as a historian, but very much on board with that project, I think hopefully something that will continue to inform the way the historians think about certainly the history of the United States. But I think what's one of the things, and maybe now we'll turn a little bit more squarely to the book, one of the things that, you know, listeners should know is that the book, you know, touches certainly on the history of racial formation in the United States, but it also does so much. And I think that's what really is exciting for us to talk about today is, you know, people have, in much the same way that Americans, white Americans found, you know, a way in through Thai food, you found a way in through Thai food to a broad range of subjects like the history of U.S. empire, immigration, the history of metropolitan areas, specifically Los Angeles, in the last half of the 20th century. So I'd love to turn maybe if we can to the first chapter, because I think, you know, we'll start with, we'll start outside the United States, with U.S. Empire, chapter one, which is, entitled One Night in Bangkok, Food and the Everyday Life of Empire. I wonder if you can tee us up a little bit by talking about what U.S. imperialism in Thailand looks like in the immediate post-war period. And based on that, right, what then is the link between U.S. empire in Asia, in Southeast Asia, and American tourism that eventually helps to introduce Americans to Thai food?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and just to kind of highlight and underscore what you said, you know, I think what was really important is that, you know, as I started writing the book or getting deeper into the writing, you know, I really found that the story of Thai America and Thai Americans through food was, you know, it made very clear that food was a sort of stimulus and register of larger transformations in American culture and society. And so, you know, it allowed me to kind of really explore the Cold War U.S. intervention in Southeast Asia, and specifically in Thailand. You know, it vacillates sort of between U.S. intervention, U.S. Empire sort of vacillates between soft power and hard power. And so you have right leading up to the Vietnam War, so the 50s and 60s, the United States begins to recognize Thailand as a strategic locale for the Cold War and communist, the spread of communism in Southeast Asia. And so it begins to establish, the United States begins to establish a number of organizations, both private and government organizations. The Southeast Asian Treaty Organization is housed or located in Bangkok. They create a number of embassies. The Peace Corps kicks off in Bangkok in the 1960s. And so you have a lot of the kind of cultural exchange programs that were the hallmarks of the Cold War period as the United States tries to, and the key here was really thinking about, you know, the United States trying to integrate, to borrow from Christina Klein, right, this Cold War global imaginary of integration, right, to try to integrate Asia and Southeast Asia under the American umbrella as allies through cultural means. Cultural exchanges, language programs, student exchanges, and food, for me, was a key part of that, in that it allowed ordinary Americans, and ordinary meaning, you know, just non-state officials, it allowed ordinary Americans, and especially white women, to learn about Thai society, to engage with Thai people, to learn about the culture and history of Thailand in their eyes, what was the culture and history of Thailand, through food practices, through cooking, through eating, through talking with their Thai servants that they hired about Thai food. And I'm thinking specifically of here, you know, a woman named Marie Wilson, who was from West Los Angeles. She was a homemaker from West Los Angeles. She goes to Thailand, you know, in the 1950s. Her husband was a Fulbright scholar, again, part of this kind of expansion of U.S. cultural programs, as a Fulbright scholar in Thailand, teaching English. And she goes to be with her husband, who was actually at the time her fiance, but she goes to be with him. And during her time in Thailand, she is, you know, collecting recipes, learning how to cook Thai food. And in 1965, upon returning home to Los Angeles, she publishes the very first, at least on record, the very first Thai cookbook in the United States called Siamese Cookery, which includes the recipes that she had collected in Thailand during her time there. And so for me, that sort of captures the way that American citizens interacted and got to know Thailand from below at the everyday level, and that was a really the crucible for creating this Thai neo-colonial subject during the Cold War period.
The thing that I find fascinating too is how the Thais themselves are also embarking on certain kinds of projects related to food, right? And this is a fascinating nugget about the creation of pad Thai as a dish in the 1940s by a prime minister, I think you write, who saw it as a way to, in fact, resist the sort of heavy Chinese influence that he saw infiltrating Thai culture and Thailand. How do we square, you know, these different directions in which, you know, food is being used as a political project, you know, both for U.S. imperialism, but also for Thai nation building in the 1940s, 1950s?
Yeah, no, I'm glad that you brought that up because, you know, so at the time, you know, or actually not at the time, but in the 1930s, you know, Chinese migrants, Chinese immigrants had always sort of had a presence or had a long presence in Thailand up to that period. And under Prime Minister Phibun Songkram, Thailand really wanted to kind of separate themselves and distinguish themselves from the Chinese population, right? To establish a kind of Thai national identity, and Pad Thai becomes the created as and established and tapped as the national Thai dish as a way, again, to carve out and craft this distinctly Thai identity that was separate from Chinese-ness. And you see that again play out in the Cold War. So when the United States is trying to sort of bring Thailand under its camp during the Cold War period, it also influences a number of Thai leaders, Thai prime ministers. So Sarit Thanarat in the 1950s and 60s is cracking down on kind of leftist movements in Thailand in the service of U.S. empire and imperialism. And so Thailand, you know, even then, there's a crackdown on sort of the Chinese because there's a fear that they're going to sort of spread communism in Thailand, and it directly gets placed, directly on the Chinese. And so that creation of Pad Thai kind of even gives us a glimpse into the Cold War period in terms of Thai national identity in relationship to Chinese-ness. And for, you know, the way that we can sort of square that is, you know, for a lot of the American tourists that come and become fascinated with Thai food, you know, they start to mask a lot of these ethnic, and that's the way that I kind of approached it, right? It's like you have this very tenuous, violent history of repression and exclusion. And then you have these American tourists who arrive in Thailand, and culinary tourists in particular, and they begin to render a very romantic, idealized vision of a Thailand that they wanted to believe existed, that it was a multi-ethnic, diverse melting pot of Indian, South Asian Indians, Chinese, and all kinds of different people. And so they start to retell the history of Thailand and Thai culture in this way through food, that if we look at the food of Thailand, that they've been sort of combining all of these different ingredients from the Portuguese to the Chinese to Indians, that it reflects this harmony. It reflects this, the way that Thailand as a country has been able to bring together different kinds of people. And it just wasn't true, right? That there was a violent history of, again, sort of repression and exclusion. But the way that these American culinary tourists were telling the story was rendering that invisible. And they had no, you know, again, it's important to remember that they had no desire to tell that story of the Thai government repressing groups. But, you know, I think the effect of that was to really craft and create this idea of a Thai neo-colonial, or not an ideal, not the idea, but it really crafted this Thai neo-colonial subject and informed how Americans back in the United States came to understand Thai people.
Yeah, I love how you've sort of married those two phenomena together, actually. It makes a lot of sense to sort of see it as a way in which a much messier reality gets sort of papered over, you know, through food, whether it's from outside culinary tourists or inside, right, in terms of the repression of Chinese members of Thai society. There's so much that I want to talk about for each chapter, but, you know, we have so little time. So I feel like, you know, maybe we can sort of progress the second chapter in the book, which is entitled Chasing the Yum, Food Procurement and Early Thai Los Angeles. And this brings us to the United States in terms of the immigration story of Thais to the United States. And actually, maybe we can start this particular part of the conversation by thinking about what you said earlier, and something that I was sort of fascinated by, more of a historiographical question than anything else. But you write in this chapter that Thais actually made up the largest immigrant group to the United States between 1965 and 1975, which I don't think a lot of people would understand or realize to be the case. So given, you know, even though the numbers, objectively speaking, are maybe smaller, you know, you do have during this very critical period during Cold War history, the fact that Thais are the largest immigrant group to the United States. So why, in your view, why do you think Thais as a group have been sort of overlooked, as you said earlier in our conversation, in Asian American historiography? What accounts for that invisibility in the intellectual accounting of Asian America?
Yeah, that is an excellent question. And, you know, just to add to what you're saying, you know, they were also the most rapid immigrant or the immigrant group that immigrated most rapidly during that period as well. And so they were up there in terms of not just in terms of sheer numbers, but also the percentage. And in part, that's also because there were so few Thai in the United States before the Cold War. And so, you know, it grew rapidly by, you know, 300-400% in that year because there were so few to begin with. But in terms of your question, I mean, I think that's that's an excellent one that I've sort of been thinking about for quite a while. And the best answer that I have for that is I think Thai Americans don't, in Asian American historiography and in Asian American studies, we don't fit the kind of standard narrative of post-war Vietnam era migration to the United States, right? We don't fall into, you're kind of, we're not large enough at the time to really garner enough attention as, you know, Chinese, Japanese, Korean immigrants. But we also don't fall into the category of Southeast Asian Americans. And there's been a number of times where, you know, I remember writing or contributing to a piece or contributing a piece to a journal. And one of the reviewers had mentioned, you know, it was a special edition on Southeast Asian Americans. And one of the reviewers had mentioned that, you know, they don't really see Thais as part of the Southeast Asian diaspora, which for me, you know, wasn't. You know, I wasn't so much offended as I was, you know, what's the sort of intellectual or explanation or rationale for that? And there's been a number of cases where, you know, I've talked to community organizers who have said the same thing, right? That, you know, we're organizing for Southeast Asian Americans. We don't really consider Thais as Southeast Asians. And so it really becomes, Southeast Asian becomes obviously a political category that to me encompasses and includes direct victims of the Vietnam War in terms of refugee populations and those on the receiving end of military aggression. And Thais, because they were allies, informal sort of allies with the United States during the Cold War, I just don't think Asian American historians and Asian American studies scholars really know what to do with Thais.
Yeah, and I love the way that you found an end to this problem in some ways by tying it to some of the more recent scholarship. I'm thinking about Melon Chu's book on the Good Immigrants by looking at, you know, other folks who may not also fit that conventional stereotype of who Asian American immigrants or refugees are in the post-war period, and you use you introduce a couple of phrases that are some that were circulating in the Thai community, like the concept of the Robin Hood as an identity, and you also then introduce a new way for us to think about what they do with their lives as what you call ex-documented people. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, in the context of chapter two, what are these concepts, the Robin Hood, the ex-documented, and how do they understand, how do they help us understand Thai migration during this period?
Yeah, I mean, I think that undocumented Thais, and I'll say a little bit more about what I mean by ex-documented, but undocumented and ex-documented Thais who come in the 1960s and 70s are central to the story of Thai food in the United States, in that they are the cooks and the restaurant workers that make the Thai restaurant industry possible. But just to backtrack, in terms of Thai immigration, one of the most fascinating things that I found, or aspects of Thai immigration, is that the first wave of Thai immigrants were largely Thai students, and they were on paper, sort of middle class, urban, a lot of them were Chinese, ethnic Chinese Thai. And so they start coming in the late 50s, 60s. But by the late 60s, and especially in the 70s, you start to see this pattern of Thais using student visas. And this is sort of the link to Madeline Chu's book, using student visas to enter into the United States in order to join family members and friends. And then they would just overstay their visas. And so there was a black market that started to develop around, and you needed an I-20 form that colleges would grant in order for you to come over as just one of the documents you needed. But you started to see like this black market of I-20 forms develop in Thailand, where you just had a bunch of Thai people who were like, what's the easiest way I can get to the United States? I'll just say that I'm going to go study there. A lot of them were actually, or some of them, I should say, were not well off. And so that was the other thing that I discovered, right? Is like on paper, you see Thai students as immigrants and you think, oh, they're, you know, they're very fairly well off. They have some money. They're able to come here and study. But what they were really doing was, you know, if they had to get an I-20 form in Thailand, you know, one of the requirements was to show that you had money in your bank account and that you would actually return upon completing your studies. And so Thai people would borrow some money, put it in a bank account, print the bank statement, take it to the embassy, get their I-20 granted, and then before leaving, they would just pull the money out of the bank account. And so there were ways that, you know, Thais were able to come under legal, valid documents. And then by the 1980s, student visas, the preferred valid document shifted from student visas to tourist visas. So you had more Thais coming under tourist visas and student visas, but doing the same thing, right? Using tourist visas, entering the United States, and then overstaying and building lives here. And so, you know, I call that process, or I refer to those Thais as ex-documented, because I think it's important to highlight the fact that, you know, especially now, you know, I believe in 2005, over 50% of immigrants who came or undocumented immigrants who entered the United States entered with valid legal documents. And so I don't think we've, you know, historically really began to unpack that and what that means for identities and communities and for the experiences of people who come with valid legal documents and then, you know, stay, inhabit a place, work, build lives, and then, you know, overstay the terms of their statuses and what that actually means for citizenship and belonging. And in terms of Robin Hood, that was a, you know, I enjoyed seeing that term just because, you know, I think for those of us who are familiar with the fairy tale of Robin Hood, right? Someone, a character that steals from the rich and gives to the poor, a kind of moral, a character who is committing a crime, but has the heart of gold. And that is, I think, how Thais came to understand themselves as when they began to overstay their visas. And so the term Robin Hood refers to undocumented Thais living in the United States, right? They refer to themselves as Robin Hoods. And I think in large part, because of that, because they felt like, yeah, we might be overstaying the visas, we might be committing a crime, but we have a right to be here. Given the relationship between the United States and Thailand, we have a right to be here, and we're doing nothing wrong, and we're actually contributing to society.
Yeah, the resourcefulness of the Thai students and immigrants who come to the United States during this period is beautifully laid out in this chapter. And again, I wish we had time to sort of go into the details of really the content of this chapter, which is more about food procurement. And you use the Bangkok Market grocery store as a case example of how Thai immigrants employ strategies of substitution and smuggling and traveling long distances in order to get the ingredients that they need to make the food that they want to make, and then eventually, you know, even sort of flourish into using free trade zones in Mexico to grow produce and import that for their own use. And all of this just speaks to a culture of really innovation from below, right? This actually, to me, was almost a chapter of business history that I found really exciting, because it was business history from the margins of how these businesses get run in incredibly challenging circumstances. But again, fortunately, we don't have as much time today to dig into that, although listeners should certainly check out that chapter if that's an interest that they have. I think now we've got the interest in Thai food that's generated by culinary tourism to Thailand, which you talked about from the first chapter. We've got Thais in the United States now after immigrating in chapter two. So we now come to chapter three, which is about the restaurants themselves. And the title of chapter three is Too Hot to Handle: Restaurants and Thai American Identity. So what is the story of the Thai restaurant in the United States, right? I think you lay out that in chapter three, it is it sort of gets started in Los Angeles. That's sort of ground zero for Thai restaurants. So what is that story of the Thai restaurant in the United States?
Yeah, I mean, I think for this particular story, I was really interested in thinking about the themes of, you know, what role did kind of multiculturalism play, and how do you create a market for a cuisine, for a new cuisine, in a place like Los Angeles, and what does that process look like? And I zero right in on the Thai restaurant boom in Los Angeles in the 1970s and 80s. To talk about and to really focus on the ways that the restaurants themselves shaped Thai American identity, both in terms of sort of racial and ethnic identity, you know, creating novelty. How do you create novelty and distinction in marketplace, in consumer culture, when there are other Asian cuisines that are popular in the city as well? What does that distinction, how do you make those distinctions? And so I focused a lot on the role of taste and flavors and smells as a way to mark racial and ethnic distinction. And Thai restaurateurs, chefs, as well as local food writers really hone in on the senses other than sight, human senses other than sight, smell, flavors, to mark that distinction for this new cuisine. And the other thing I wanted to focus on in that chapter was what happens inside the restaurant, both in terms of the food that's on the plate and how that marks distinction, and also the decor and the environment that's created by the restaurateurs themselves. And as a way to kind of mark distinction and create novelty. And more importantly, the last part of that chapter, I think for me, it was really important to talk about what happens behind the kitchen door, right? What is the relationship between Thai restaurateurs and the workers who work in the kitchens and serve the food and cook the food, and how Thai restaurants became incubators of both a Thai American middle class and a Thai American working class, and how this was fueled by this growing consumer culture in Los Angeles, and a rising kind of multiculturalism as Los Angeles emerges as a global city in the 1980s. So those are some of the themes that I really wanted to touch on in this chapter. And more specifically for the story of Thai restaurants, it starts out in you have the first Thai restaurant opening in 1961 in the East Hollywood, Vermont, right along Vermont in East Hollywood. And by the 70s and 80s, you have over 50 that open in West Hollywood, catering to this white middle class, white middle and upper class clientele, and to create a market for the food. And one of the interesting, I'll point out two quick things. One of the first restaurateurs is Pramod Tilaka Mongkun of the Tilaka Mongkun family. He opens the Bangkok market. His son is now a very popular celebrity chef on Food Network. But they're one of the first families to open a Thai restaurant in the West Hollywood area. And part of what Pramod did was, you know, he realized, you know, not that many people know about Thai food. He opens up his restaurant right next to Fox Studios on Pico and gives free food away for about a week, anybody passing by. And, you know, a lot of the workers and writers and those in the show business that worked at Fox Studios became hooked, according to his son, became hooked on Thai food because they were eating it for free originally, but they got hooked. And so there's also an element of there's also, you know, a part of the chapter where I try to make a link between, you know, what it means to open up a restaurant in Hollywood and the kind of cultural cachet and trendiness that becomes, you know, Thai food becomes seen as a trend, it becomes hip, it becomes cool, in part because there are so many celebrities that begin to eat it from the music industry, from the movie industry. Victor Sotsuk, who opens the Siamese Princess in West Hollywood, in Santa Monica as well, in his cookbook, in newspaper articles at the time, you know, mentions, you know, never fails to mention all of the celebrities, Prince, Harrison Ford, Madonna, never fails to mention all of the celebrities that come to eat at his restaurant. And so I think there is that kind of element of what allows or what helped Thai food become so popular is because they opened in the Hollywood area and the kind of being associated with show business and the glitz and glamour of Hollywood kind of helped the growth of Thai food and the popularity of Thai food as well.
Yeah, it's fascinating how it actually turned out to be quite a fortuitous event that you know, Thai immigrants, when they arrived in the United States, settle in Los Angeles. I think in part you mentioned because of the number of educational institutions in the city that can sustain the student population that was coming, as you said, with an I-20 form to presumably to study. But that actually, you know, as you said, also puts them in the vicinity of Hollywood and the music industry and other folks who are able to lend that cultural cachet to Thai food when it comes on the scene. And that's, you know, a combination of factors is fortuitous, but quite important to the historical narrative. I wanted to ask specifically about another restaurateur you hadn't mentioned, because you start off this chapter by talking about Tommy Tang, who opens Tommy Tang Siamese Cafe on Melrose Avenue in WeHo in West Hollywood, and serves things like Thai risotto and duck and arugula salad. And I'm wondering, you know, because we've talked a lot about the ways in which ideas about food and practices of food are and ingredients are flowing back and forth between Southeast Asia and the United States. Do chefs like Tommy Tang, you know, who some might say adapted or innovated on Thai cuisine, do their practices and ideas get re-exported or re-exported to Thailand? Do you see, this is not, you know, really, I think, part of the chapter, but I'm just curious whether there is that kind of, you know, cultural hybridity that ends up back in Bangkok or ends up back in Thailand based on what Thais are doing in the United States with Thai food.
Yeah, I certainly think that there was an element of that happening in terms of Thai food culture in Thailand changing because of the kind of Thai food that was being cooked in the United States. But I would argue that we really begin to see that more recently. Even when Tommy Tang was cooking his food, he was getting a lot of pushback and a lot of criticism from the Thai community about not cooking Thai food the traditional way. We really start to see this gain some traction in the early 2000s when the Thai government decides to standardize the taste of Thai food under the Thai Kitchen of the World program, and that was the name at the time, but it's changed. The name has changed a number of times since, but the Thai Kitchen to the World program was a response to that, was a response to the fact that Thai people in the United States were cooking Thai food in very innovative ways. And so the Thai government decides we need a standardized taste. We need a standardized, authentic Thai taste. And so I see that push by the Thai government to promote what they consider authentic Thai cuisine with a standard in terms of cooking and preparation methods and taste, as a response to all the kind of innovation that was taking place in the United States in the 80s and 90s.
I wonder now if one of the things we might do with the time that we have left is actually turn to the last two chapters and almost talk about them a little bit in tandem, because I think one of the things that these two chapters give us is a sense of how Thai food travels beyond or exists beyond the restaurant, which is sort of the most obvious place in which one expects to encounter it. But as you talk about, you know, it becomes in chapter four a food festival that takes place, as we've alluded to in our introductory comments, at a Thai Buddhist temple called Wat Thai. And chapter four is entitled More Than a Place of Worship, Food Festivals and Thai American Suburban Culture. But then you also talk about in chapter five, the creation of Thai Town, right, which is encompasses certainly lots of restaurants within a certain area of East Hollywood, but is a larger sort of cultural space that gets carved out to service culinary tourism to a specific area in LA. So I'd love to maybe use our last several minutes to talk about these two chapters together in ways that illuminate how Thai food then becomes a site of contest, both with white Americans who are reacting to it, but also fault lines that begin to appear between, for example, older Thais and younger Thais who are the progenitors of the Thai Community Development Center. So perhaps we can, if you could tell us, could you tell us a little bit about the issue with Wat Thai in 1979, right? There's a food festival, and you've sort of suggested earlier that there is a conflict. What is that conflict? And what are people so worked up about when it comes to Thai food outside of the restaurant setting?
Right. Now, that's a very important question, because I had sort of mentioned it at the beginning that in 2007, the city of Los Angeles issued a moratorium on Thai food festivals at Wat Thai. And that the interesting kind of, I guess, entry point into this history is that one of the neighbors at the time, or one of the suburban residents, so Wat Thai is situated right in a suburban neighborhood at the end of a suburban street, suburban neighborhood in North Hollywood, sort of where North Hollywood, Sun Valley, Arleta intersect. Very multiracial. It was the neighborhood I grew up in, very multiracial, working class. And so one of the neighbors pulls out a zoning ordinance and says, "Hey, look, I found this zoning ordinance in the 1980s that says you can't have Thai food festivals on the weekends." And so the city of Los Angeles agrees with the resident and issues the moratorium. And so the story I tell in that chapter is that history from the early 1980s, really throughout the 1980s. It was, the battle, the conflict took place over a number of years. And really what it centered on was you had a group of suburban residents, mostly white, but you had, I think, a couple of Latino suburbanites, part of this neighborhood committee as well. And they were taking issue with the fact that the Thai temple had been organizing festivals, food festivals, every single weekend that drew thousands of people, almost every weekend, who came to listen to music, to eat food. This food at the Thai temple was some of the most, what could be considered some of the most authentic in Los Angeles, because it was catering specifically to Thais. The menus were written in Thai. A lot of the ingredients, or not just the ingredients, but a lot of the dishes were specifically for that you couldn't find on the menu in a lot of restaurants. And so, you have thousands of Thais who were coming to celebrate, not just during holidays, but coming to celebrate holidays, but also just coming to celebrate life at the temple, and really using the temple as a public space, as a community space. And I think that's really important to say that Thais, both in that neighborhood, but also around Southern California, there weren't very many community spaces. And so the Thai temple becomes
in a physical space where they can meet and interact, both with other ties, but also across racial and ethnic lines. And so because of that, the neighbors, all of those activities clashed with the neighbors' own suburban ideals, right? They had moved into the neighborhood. A number of them had moved into the neighborhood in the 1950s and 60s and really wanted that middle class 50s suburban ideal, peace, quiet, tree-lined streets. And this vision, the Thai American manifestation of suburban culture, flew right in the face of a traditional and dominant notions of the suburbs that the neighbors wanted to defend. And so they essentially, took it to the zoning board, to the city zoning board, and argued that the Thai temple was violating. So the Thai temple was operating on a conditional use permit. They were allowed. The kind of funny thing to me is always, they were allowed to hold these festivals, and they were allowed to operate in the suburbs because temple officials promised that it was going to be a kind of meditative space. It was going to be a quiet meditative space. And I laugh because I know, even at the time, I knew that the temple officials knew it wasn't going to be that. but this was their way to get that they could operate in the suburban neighborhood. When they were granted that permit, the neighbors were fine with it because their kind of orientalist ideas of a Buddhist temple was going to be peace and quiet and monks praying and not that many people showing up. And so they didn't think it was going to be an issue. And so they end up going back to that conditional use permit and saying the temple festivals need to be shut down because they're violating this permit. They're not supposed to be having these festivals. It's causing parking problems, noise, traffic. People are throwing trash and chicken skewers, used chicken skewers on our lawns. People are parking their cars in our driveways. And so it became this huge, kind of what was described by the local media as a huge culture clash that really, I think, highlighted the fact that issues of immigration, issues of race, multiculturalism were happening, and were increasingly taking place and playing out in the suburbs.
Yeah, I think it's really important. I think you said this earlier already, but for listeners who may be interested in the history of cities or suburbs, I'm thinking of work that others have done, like Andrew Sandoval Strauss at the University of New Mexico, that explore sort of more distinctive immigrant ideals of suburbanization and practices of suburbanization, right? That reflect an equally valid suburban experience that certainly seem to go against, as you said, the sort of nostalgic 1950s model of suburbanization that not only those folks think about, but I think a lot of times still scholars of urbanism and metropolitan areas, are still kind of using as conventions. So I think this is a particularly important intervention in that sense. Which brings us to chapter five. I think one of the things that perhaps is a cause for the kind of conflict that happens around Wat Thai is that there isn't as much a sort of communal political center that comes to be formed in the 1980s with the Thai Community Development Center and the development of Thai Town, and the ways in which the Thai community actually begins to cultivate the kind of political leverage within Los Angeles that gives it this particular area in East Hollywood. So how does Thai Town come to be and what is its significance to your story?
Yeah, so, Thai Town gets established in 1999. It's a 6-block stretch of East Hollywood from Western to Normandy. So Western on the Western side of Hollywood Boulevard and Normandy on the Eastern side. And it really comes to be because of, the effort of the Thai Community Development Center, which was created also in the 1990s, directed by Chancey Martorell, who was a Thai American political activist had been, you know, organizing around Thai American issues ever since she was an undergraduate at UCLA. And I think the best way to kind of think about what Thai Town means is, you know, in the or a great kind of entry point into it is that in the 1990s, you know, when Chansey was organizing to help Thai immigrants in Los Angeles, you know, she tells a newspaper reporter, you know, that we need to start organizing around real issues, not just cultural events and food festivals. And this was before she really delved into the creation of Thai Town. And so I found that really fascinating because here you have a political activist who is really interested in improving the lives of working class, poor, often undocumented Thai immigrants, did not want to focus on food, felt like food was a distraction. But by the time Thai Town gets established in 1999, it's sort of makes that turn and becomes committed to using Thai restaurants and culinary tourism to spur revitalization of Thai Town. And so Thai Town is in part known as Thai Town because of the number of Thai restaurants in the neighborhood. And that neighborhood in the 70s and 80s was multi-ethnic, multiracial. A large number of recently arrived Thais moved to Thai Town, moved to the East Hollywood area. And, you know, it was from the city's point of view, you know, a sign of urban blight, right? That it was deteriorating. There were, you know, there was drug abuse and crime. And so they were really thinking about, you know, how do we revitalize this area? And Thai CDC, the Thai Community Development Center, spearheads these efforts. Appealing to, and this is kind of what I argue and really what I explore, right, begins to appeal to the city of Los Angeles's attempts to market and brand itself as a very cosmopolitan, again, global city with ties to Asia and the Pacific. And, you know, I think Chanti and other members of the Thai community recognize that there is a potential for getting funding and getting investment for this redevelopment if we appeal to that sense of what we might call kind of a liberal multicultural approach to urban development. And so I think that's how kind of Thai Town comes to be. But I will say that one of the really interesting things about Thai Town is that it's not your typical story of urban redevelopment. So there were, of course, kind of situations where Thai restaurants and Thais were kind of pushing out other kinds of businesses and marginalizing, I think would be a good word, sort of marginalizing Latinos in the area and other recently arrived immigrants from Latin America and Central America. But they also made a concerted effort, especially, you know, in more recent years, Chansey has also made a more concerted effort to take in into consideration the ideas and wants and needs of all of the community members that live in that area. And so they just created, you know, or they just established, but it had been in the making for a couple of years, a Thai Town marketplace, kind of a farmer's market for the neighborhood to address issues of food insecurity. And that was developed in large part because she started listening to what all of the residents in the neighborhood wanted, as opposed to just what Thais and Thai business owners wanted. So I think it's a little bit of a different model of revitalization and redevelopment than we sort of typically think of, i.e. gentrification.
Yeah, and it's certainly a model that we hope others would take up more actively. I think for me, the chapter is really wonderful in how it sort of brings the story full circle from the culinary tourism that we talked about earlier in the 1950s into something that Thai Americans are able to in some ways reappropriate, right, for the development of Thai Town and the economic support and resources that generates, not just, again, as you said, for the Thai community, but also for other residents in the area. So we've come to sort of the end of the conversation. I do want to say, just for listeners, again, that there is so much in this book that we've only really scratched the surface. I would actually have loved to have talked a little bit more about the conclusion it offers, you know, for any graduate students who are interested in any of these fields, essentially an excellent bibliographic essay. It was a great sort of a reminder for me of what all the great work that's being done out there. But I think for me, the most important part of the conclusion was a very riveting call to action that you have at the end about how you know, commercial foodways can indeed spark radical social justice-based political activism across racial and ethnic lines, and that that's not just by eating food or breaking bread with each other, as you write, but actually realizing that all of this food has been shaped by larger forces. Things like racial formation, things like imperialism, and that's what's brought us into contact with some of these food cultures. I'll let listeners explore that on their own. But since we are coming to the end of our conversation, Mark, I wonder if you could end by telling us about what you're working on at the moment, now that this book is done.
Yeah, no, I'd love to. I'm currently finishing up an article right now on post-World War II Asian American suburban cultures. So thinking about the various kind of leisure and cultural practices of different Asian and Pacific Islander groups, and, you know, who moved to the suburbs in the late 20th century, and how those practices allowed these communities to assert a right to the suburb, to assert a right to be full-fledged participants in American suburban life. So really, again, thinking about that theme of who shapes the suburban ideal and who has control and ownership of the suburban ideal, and the way that, you know, leisure practices and everyday practices, so not just kind of political and political organizations or policies, help with this, but also the way that everyday life and everyday practices are ways to inhabit a space and also make claims on a space. And so I'm currently finishing up that right now, and that will be coming out in the Oxford Encyclopedia of American History, hopefully soon, in the next couple of months. And then I'm also working on my next full-length book project, which is on the history of race and public health inspections of ethnic restaurants in the United States. And I'm going to focus specifically on Asian restaurants. And so to really tell this history of, you know, I think a lot of us are familiar with the narrative of ethnic food and ethnic restaurants being dirty, you know, unclean, getting failing grades by health inspectors, being forced to shut down. But I think I really want to unpack this story of the way that food, discourses of food, disease, immigrantness have developed over time, and how that's actually really informed the way that we think about how we police Asian restaurants in the United States. And again, just to think about the significance of food and foodways in American society as something that both reflects but also registers, you know, these kind of larger social, cultural, political transformations. So that's kind of the next book project that I'm working on. And finally, I'm collaborating with my good colleague Kanchana Tepporilak at Northern Illinois University on the first edited collection on Thai American studies. So we want to put together a reader on Thai American history, popular culture, religion, and politics. And so I'm currently working on that as well.
Well, that sounds like a lot on your plate, but they all sound like fantastic projects. And especially as we've talked about, you know, filling in the gaps as we make a more robust and inclusive picture of what the Asian American community looks like. So I want to thank you, Mark, for being on the show today. Really enjoyed reading the book and having a chance to talk to you about it. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I'm grateful for being on the show, and I thank you for having me and giving me the opportunity.
All right, take care.
All right, thank you.